I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, acclaimed British writer Robert McFarlane talks about his kinship with the natural world and marvels at how language reflects its beauty.
I'm fascinated by where matter meets metaphor. The underworld is not just where we gain our raw materials from, where, you know, natural disasters erupt from. It's this unbiddable, scarcely known, deep realm that we walk on every day. We walk on the crust. Our feet are the things that keep us in contact with the earth.
And later, inspired by the tale of Gilgamesh, McFarlane talks about his love of music and his collaboration with singer-songwriter Johnny Flynn.
You know, no one would ever want to watch a writer write. It's paint drying, it's grass growing, but musicians are magicians weaving golden thread that they pluck from the air.
From mountains to the underworld to the magic of music, we go inside the mind of one of the great living nature writers, Robert McFarlane. That's coming up on Life Examined. Robert McFarlane grew up loving mountains. You could even say they were in his DNA. His father was a mountaineer, and his grandfather oversaw some of the early expeditions and the first summit of Mount Everest in the 1950s. McFarlane's own passion for the extremes of the mountains and nature fostered yet another interest, writing. And in his first book called Mountains of the Mind, published when he was only 25, McFarlane explores why he fell in love with mountains and seeks answers as to why so many are willing to die for their love of reaching the summit. McFarlane's interest in looking upwards may well have inspired his latest book, Underlands, A Deep Time Journey. While the upper world is a place of the gods and awe, the subterranean world is an unseen place, a territory for burial and hiding. For McFarlane, the underworld is also a place where matter meets metaphor. Negative words like down, dark, or depressed are deeply ingrained in our language and mythology. Robert McFarlane joins me now to talk about his exploration and interest in what lies beneath our feet. He's a fellow at Emmanuel College at Cambridge University in the UK, and he's written numerous other books on nature and landscape, including The Old Ways and Landmarks. Well, Robert McFarlane, I'm so happy to have you on finally here to Life Examined. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Lovely, lovely to be here. I'm speaking from the 99 million year old chalk of South Cambridge today.
Oh, perfect. Well, we're happy to hear your voice in Southern California. And there's so much I want to talk to you about. I'm just so happy to have you on the program. You've recently been writing about this, the amazing exploration and the larger metaphors of the underworld. And I want to get to that too, and so many other things. But in many ways, you started your career looking at what are some of the highest points in the world, which are mountains. And as a young man, you were fascinated by them. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that kind of instinctual love you had for the mountains growing up.
Yeah, well, they have my heart, the mountains, and they always will. I'm not a young man anymore, but I'm not quite an older person yet. But I can tell that, you know, I'll always lift my eyes to the hills, which makes it doubly strange that I live in one of the flattest parts of the world, in the Fens in Cambridge. But they went deep, bone deep from an early age. And my grandfather was a mountaineer. He was a diplomat and a mountaineer, and he oversaw and helped with the organization of the Everest expeditions in the early 50s, one of which obviously was the first to reach the summit of Everest. He loved the Alps. His parents died when he was young. His father was committed to a sanatorium in the Alps because he had tuberculosis. My grandfather grew up in the mountains, and he was the person, you know, who would tell me the stories, and I would look with awe at these witchy tools he had, these skis that were wooden skis that were, you know, taller than he was, these crampons, these axes, and they were the magician's art. They were the magician's wands that levitated him.
And in the process of you loving mountains, you began to write about them, some of your earliest writing. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what you were getting at. For example, you talked about the changing relationship that humans had with the mountains that maybe began some 300 years ago. What's that all about?
So the first book I wrote, it's 20 years old next year, which does make me gasp a little bit. It's called Mountains of the Mind, and it came out in 2003, which was the 50th anniversary of the first ascent of Everest. And I remember being, I was climbing in the sort of greater ranges. I was in Kyrgyzstan, big dangerous, avalanche-y, glacial territory. And I was leading a small group of three friends. And, you know, I was inadequate to those mountains by a long way, and they were less experienced than I was. So I felt this terrible combination of responsibility and menace. And I remember one day when I was just out of it with altitude sickness on this glacier called the Inalchek Glacier, under this incredible 7,000 meter peak of pink marble called Khan Tengri, wandering up the glacier and finding a cemetery there, this little boulder, sort of improvised mountaineer's cemetery, and just looking at the plaques with the names scratched on them of the people who died on those mountains around me. And I suddenly had this kind of the view in from the outside to the religion that I was part of, this devotion that was unquestionable to me. You know, of course you climb mountains, why wouldn't you? And I suddenly found it astonishing that I, you know, was risking my life and the lives of others, doing what I loved. But also I then began to realize, because I was trained as a literary scholar and a cultural historian, I also began to realize that this was anomalous historically within the broader Western tradition. So we didn't start climbing mountains for pleasure in Europe until the late second half of the 18th century. And when you look at it like that and it becomes this young sort of invention, then it's even weirder. So I wanted to solve that double puzzle. Why had I fallen in love with it? But why culturally are we now at a place where, you know, Everest has 300 people in a queue in the death zone every May weather window?
Yeah, my sense is that more than 300 years ago, mountains would have been kind of menacing, something to avoid, that you may have to get over if you were forced to. But certainly there was this change where they became something, I think you've used the word, a secular religion or pilgrimage or something or the other, that has really captured our imagination.
Yeah. I mean, either things to be feared or things to be revered, I guess. So there's clearly we've long located our gods and our deities. Many religions have in high places. And, you know, the Bible tells us, lift up thine eyes to the hills, from thence will come thy salvation. You know, there's an awe and a reverence directed towards high ground. It's a place, precisely because it was a place that wasn't reached. It was otherworldly. And you know, and it still is. The upper world is another world. When I look at George Mallory and Sandy Irvin and those early Everest pioneers of the 1920s, they were astronauts, right? They were going where to a realm which had never been reached before, above 8,000 meters. They were astonishing explorers, absolutely pushing the bounds of human durability and possibility. So it's taken us a long time to kind of secularize and tame the mountains, and largely we've done that, though of course mountains can still remind us of their blazing indifference to our schemes.
I wonder if you could just expand on what you mentioned earlier, which is just this kind of mythological or biblical notion of looking up towards something. And I think this will perhaps take us to some of your later work, which is looking down. But we really have this notion of an up and a down and a good and a bad. We kind of polarize the two.
Yeah. It's a metaphor we live by, to borrow that amazing phrase. So it's one of the simplest. And I think in many but not all cultures, down is bad and up is good. I paint with a broad brush here, but the sublime is the lofty. We excel. We raise up. We rise up. That's what that word carries within it as an axis. To become depressed, to feel down, to be low, to be downtrodden. You know, all of these metaphors of descent are grained deep into our language as negatives, and the underworld, in many cultures, but not all, is often a place of the dead, of the shadow realm. The upper world is a place of the gods. In the Norse three-tiered cosmos, which is kind of joined by this amazing world tree, which grows between the realms. The mortal realm is the middle realm. The realm of the gods is the upper realm, the canopy, if you like, of the world tree, and down in the roots is the monstrous, is the realm of the dead and the underworld.
Mm. Well, it's interesting that your first book 20 years ago was Looking Up, and most recently the most recent book you've put out is Looking Down, Underworld. And so maybe you can tell us about why you felt it was important to move in the other direction.
Well, yeah, there's a simple sort of gravitational logic, I guess, looked at across 20 years nearly, which is, you know, from high to low. In between those books, I wrote a book called The Wild Places about sort of valleys and forests and peaks and islands. And then I wrote a book called The Old Ways, which was about paths that we, you know, the paths that run through us as well as they run through places, this metaphor of the life as a path. So in a sense, the trodden paths are the beginning of the underworld, if you like, because they're harrowed a little down into the land, hollowed by feet and by time and by wheels. So there were lots of things pointing me down, but actually there were real world events that really confirmed that this was where I should look next. And in 2010, it still amazes me to look back at it, the world was rocked by what I call surfacing. So basically where the underworld, which we normally keep out of sight and out of mind and confined to its sunken realm, erupted. So there was the Haitian earthquake in January. There was the Deepwater Horizon blowout deep under the sea, which obviously was a huge moment for America. There was Eyjafjallajökull, the Icelandic volcano that stopped all flights across, you know, American European airspace, I'm sure you remember. And then in the summer of that year, this all happened basically in 8 months, there was the Chilean miners, that incredible story of survival against the odds when they were trapped under the Atacama Desert and they were brought out one by one in a capsule co-designed by NASA. You know, they had come back from another space. So these four events, earthquake, volcano, oil blowout, mining collapse, these were where the underworld was declaring itself to the surface. And I just kind of couldn't ignore that concatenation.
Mm. Yeah, what did all of this mean to you? Or how did you find a way to express it? I mean, I know that one aspect of this book has to do with climate change. And that's certainly a rich theme that runs through the book. But tell us how you wanted to keep pulling at these threads.
Well, I set myself these impossible tasks and never fulfill them. So, you know, Underland is even though it's a long book, it's 500 pages nearly, but it was another 250 pages in draft, and it could have been another four times that. It is essentially unfinishable, but that's because I'm dealing, I'm fascinated by where matter meets metaphor, we could say. So the underworld is not just where we gain our raw materials from, where, you know, natural disasters erupt from. It's this unbiddable, scarcely known sort of deep realm that we walk on every day. We walk on the crust. Our feet are the things that keep us in contact with the earth. There are our palms, as it were, to the ground. But we can look up and see the light of a star that's traveled billions of years to billions of miles to reach us, but we look down and we can't see past the grass blade, past the tarmac. So, you know, it's always there, but we hardly think of it, hardly allow ourselves to think of it. Not only does it give us metal and matter, it gives us dream and myth and story. I mean, the oldest stories are underworld stories. The Epic of Gilgamesh has this 12th tablet, this slightly strange 12th tablet. It's a story of the journey to the underworld, and it's 4,000 years old. Enkidu has to go down to get a toy for Gilgamesh, and he gets trapped down there. And as I was finishing writing Underland, you know, the Enkidu story came true because I finished it in June 2018 when that Thai football team, as everyone remembers, because underworld stories go around the world, because they resonate in our psyches with such kind of vibrant power. That Thai football team went into the underworld and they got trapped.
Go on about some of the metaphors that you explored, because there seems to be, again, so many of them as we look through mythology. What were some other ones that fascinated you?
Yeah, I mean, they're everywhere, aren't they? I mean, you can tell you're writing a kind of rich but problematic book whenever someone says, what are you writing about? I say, oh, writing about the underworld. They're like, oh, what about this? What about that? What? And so that happened a lot, but I found a way to sort of sort it, at least in my own mind. And I realized that, you know, in everything I'd read, all the stories I'd come across over years of reading and research, these three themes or these three tasks of the underworld recurred. And they were to shelter, to yield, and to dispose. So if we take the idea of shelter, so that the underworld is where we put our most precious things. You know, the German government has, in Barberstollen mine, has, you know, basically all the microfiches of all state documents go down into the mine because they'll be safe against the volatilities of the upper world up there. In the Second World War, the National Gallery here in London relocated all of its paintings to a Welsh slate mine so that they wouldn't be damaged in the bombs. It's an incredible story. And we place the dead. We shelter the dead, the loved ones, right? I mean, that's the oldest of our sheltering instincts with the underworld is we put those we love in a place below the earth where they will be safe, where we will know where to come and meet them again. And we've been doing that since before we were Homo sapiens. The archaeological evidence is pretty clear on that. So that's sheltering, and then yielding. Well, we've talked a little bit about that. You know, we take oil. We've drilled millions of kilometers of borehole for oil alone. We take coal. We take all our raw materials. You know, we've been mining really as long as we've been making communities, and we also take metaphor. We take language. And we treat the underworld as an inexhaustible resource, which of course it isn't. And every time we open up a new horizon to the underworld, like deep sea mining right now, we're there to plunder it. And then the last of those, shelter, yield, and then dispose. Well, you know, we flush our waste into the sewers. Cloaca Maxima, the great kind of pit of Rome, was where all waste was thrown, and it disappeared into a hole. And we put our nuclear waste underground. You know, the stuff that scares us, we bury because we don't want it back on the surface.
There were so many other great examples you mentioned in this book. I mean, in the way that, and this is profoundly sad, but that glaciers and snow are melting and they're revealing lots of things as well. You talk about, for example, climbers that are being rediscovered out of the ice and lots of other, really, I think, permafrosts, so many examples that are very harmful. But this is all very, very dark and discouraging things when you think about where the world is at this moment.
Yeah. I call these phenomena unburials, and for me they fall into a category of the uncanny. Right, these are Anthropocene. These are very contemporary. We've sped up and disrupted Earth processes such that disclosures are happening from the underworld, unburials that should have stayed hidden for much longer. So the permafrost melt in Siberia in 2016 disclosed these reindeer corpses that had been buried a century earlier because they died of anthrax. But the anthrax hadn't died, it had just gone into the deep freeze. And so when they were unburied by these unholy temperatures, the anthrax was free to roam again. And it did, and there was an anthrax outbreak and people suffered, caribou herds suffered by the hundreds of thousands. As you say, climbers, soldiers, those who've died in war, in conflict, in trying to ascend mountains, the White War, the kind of relatively little known wars of Northern Europe of Southern Europe in the Alps. So bodies are starting to return to us across a century or more. And in the Yukon, this wolf pup turned up, again, permafrost melt, 50,000 years old, but its fur was there. It's the snarl of its lip was there, all present, found by miners, because cold holds tenderly, it preserves well, but when it's gone, it kind of offers back the dead to us, and we meet them across time. And, you know, these are not encounters we want to be having.
The metaphor is just so rich as I sit with these images with you. It's as if we're having to confront the ghosts of the past again. These are not pleasant things, right, that we're talking about here. And so what does this mean on this larger level, and that we are forced to return to the past as a result of our presence and of our actions in the present, right?
Well, ideally it's a kind of conscience stricken, we might say, that these are kind of Banquo's ghosts, right? They're the return of the dead in Macbeth who come to prick the guilty conscience of the king. We're the king, really. Here we're the king species. We're the historical materialists who kind of know what we're doing and have self-awareness of that. But I take them as warnings. I take them as signs and portents and omens. And one of the questions the book Underland asks is not mine, but is Jonas Salk's, this, you know, the great American immunologist, vaccinologist, who devised the polio vaccine and then made sure that the polio vaccine patent that he had was established such that the vaccine would be available to anyone anywhere in the world. And Salk's great searching question, the question in the eyes of that wolf pup and those climbers and those soldiers and the eyes of Banquo, is, are we being good ancestors? And it just takes a moment to settle in the mind that question, are we being good ancestors? And it took me a while to work out that to be a good ancestor is not to be a good parent. That's easy, you know, apart from at meal times or whatever, or to be a good grandparent. It's to be responsible for generations and billions of people that are yet unborn, the legacies we are leaving are their inheritance. And it's hard, hard moral work, but it seems to me a political question that every polity needs to ask itself.
It strikes me as interesting that I feel that the word ancestor has almost fallen out of vogue. It's not even one that we use anymore. And when we do come across it, I recall a show we did with Native American elders, more in indigenous cultures and societies where there's a greater sense of reciprocity with the land and a greater knowledge of how one has to live with it. And there I find the word resonates more, an ancestor, someone with knowledge and wisdom of a land and of what can be passed on to future generations.
Well, that is beautifully put, and I can't improve on it. And, you know, again and again, we find that, as it were, let's say kind of post-Enlightenment Western modernity, late capitalist modernity, whatever you want to call it, is finding that the forms of culture and thought that it has so successfully sought to extirpate or extinguish are actually those which carry the lessons that are needed. I was sort of mentored, I suppose, and inspired by a North American writer who probably be familiar to many of your listeners, Barry Lopez, who won the National Book Award in the 80s with Arctic Dreams and went on to put together this astonishing body of work. He was so far ahead of so many people. He died on Christmas Day 2020 and is still missed, but also still heard. And he's a book collection of his essays, his posthumous essays, as it were, posthumously published, has just come out, called Embrace Fearlessly the Burning World. And there's this line I can't get out of my head. He says, all has turned to water, and we are searching for the boats we have forgotten to build. And I can feel just shivering at that. We're searching for the boats we have forgotten to build. And the kinds of cultures and elders that you're talking of, they know how to build those boats. They've always known how to build those boats, but in many ways they've been deprived of the means of doing so. And the rest of us, I speak for myself at least here, we've forgotten how to build those boats.
Well, you're a father of, you have a number of children, if I know this correct.
Three children.
I thought it was three. And it, you know what strikes me maybe about the difference of being a child when we were and when your children are is this sense of what a wild space is or an unknowable space is. You know, when we were young, and maybe lots of people listening, there were no Google Maps or right there or YouTube videos of every inch of the earth, or this sense that there were still mountains that were not climbed or riverways that were not explored. But it seems to me so different in that we've made the world so knowable. It's so documented. It's so seen. I wonder what that does to imagination and to a sense of what this earth is or what these wild places are.
Yeah, well, that's a wonderful question, and one I think a lot about. We you know, the premonition is freely available, right? You want to climb a mountain? Well, you can read a 100 route descriptions before breakfast, and you can see a photo of every turn in the path, every crux in the climb. My experience is invariably that landscape surprises us. That actually, the Seven League boots we wear in our dreams as we, you know, finger walk our way across a map. It's, oh, I'll climb this and then I'll run there. And then, you know, they're not what mountains and paths and forests are made of. They're made of hard rock and, spinifex and biting insects and incredible encounters and surprises. So while I do also share a kind of anxiety about the hyper cartography within which we all exist, I also know that place will surprise us. Let's put it like that.
Isn't that true that there's such a difference between seeing the photo of the rock and then then holding it in our hands and feeling its temperature in the grooves of its own skin, and nothing can really replace that, at least yet, can it?
Wow, yes, skin is such, rock is skin. It's the skin of the earth. And when we lay a hand to it, we're meeting life. We're meeting life touch to touch, surface to surface, palm to palm. I will never tire of placing a hand on granite and feeling the pulse of the day's heat, but also of deep time coming through me. It works the other way, of course. I took my 9-year-old up Scarfell Pike in the Lake District, which is the highest mountain in England, and just last week, and it was a long awaited ambition for him, and we left in summer in the valleys, and by the time we'd got up to the tops, it was 3 degrees and visibility was very little, and the wind was whipping, and he was crying, and obviously we kept him safe, and he sang all the way down. So yeah, cried all the way up, sang all the way down, which I think is a fairly familiar mountain rhythm. And I said to him, it's different up here. This is what mountains are made of. We'll get through this, and we'll learn from it, both of us. And so we did. And I also said to him halfway, I was like, he's saying, I hate this. I'm never climbing another mountain. I said, you say that now, but you'll be amazed how quickly you forget. And I bet you in 24 hours we'll be making plans. And so we were. So yeah, the necessary amnesia of hardship.
Yes, absolutely. I love that. And in just a moment, I want to begin talking about your musical project. But I there's just so many rich themes that you've written about. And for example, just there, you've written and talked a lot about just the power of walking and pathways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in another book, even in Landmarks, the forgotten words that used to describe the land, these beautifully specific words. And I just wonder if we can reflect on some of these themes a little bit while I have you, because they've been so important in my reading and for so many others.
Oh, yeah. Well, it comes back to this idea of reciprocality, which you launched us upon with your beautiful description of stone as skin, of rock as skin. And I came to realize that in a sense we were losing a language for landscape. And I say we here, I mean, I'm talking about myself and others like me, let's say. In Britain, there was a now notorious incident where a very widely used junior dictionary used in schools across the country, so sort of 4 to 8 year olds, dropped the words acorn, conker, catkin, bluebell, willow, wren, heron, etc. from the dictionary because they were felt to no longer be relevant to childhood. And in their place, they added block graph, bulletin board, MP3 player, I kid you not, which of course is now thoroughly extinct. Exactly, right? Herons are still around, but MP3 players are in museums. So, and that became something of a kind of cause celebre for thinking about the relationship between language and nature and the imagination. And I made these books, The Lost Words and The Lost Spells, with the artist Jackie Morris in response to that. And so I began this bigger project of sort of salvage etymology, I suppose you could call it, gathering words which seemed to me much more kind of vibrant and reciprocal and dynamic in from many of the languages and dialects and sub-dialects that we have in my island group. I don't want to call it the British Isles, it's much more and more complex than that. So from the Gaelic, the Irish, which is also a Gaelic but a different one to the Scottish Gaelic, Welsh, you know, Cornish, etc. So about 30 languages and dialects, sub-dialects. I gathered about 4,000 words. Some of them. So I'll give you some examples. Runach Moim is Gaelic, Scottish Gaelic, out Hebridean term. I just love it so much. It means the shadows cast on moorland by clouds on a sunny, windy day. It does all of that in basic, yeah, well, yeah, four syllables, really. And it translates literally as mackerel moor, runach moim. And if you think of the sides of a mackerel, I don't know if it's a familiar fish there, but they have these beautiful, dappled, mottled flanks. And so the metaphor works by taking the vision of the landscape where the clouds are casting their shadows, their dynamic shadows, they're moving, but they look like a mottling or a blotching. And then it comes back through the fish that are so crucial to the subsistence of those islands and then lifts up into the drama of metaphor. And so there's a whole kind of cultural Weltanschauung, like a worldview embedded of work, of love, of attention, embedded in that tiny, tiny phrase. And it's just brilliant. And so I gathered so many examples of that kind of word. Blinter, which is the kind of sparkling glitter that's given off by fine snow as it falls, that kind of thing.
And I can't help but think that these words were the products of tribes or humans that grew up or evolved with the landscapes in which they lived, that language and land were almost just so deeply intertwined. A friend of mine reminded me of a great phrase, which is that we live at the level of our language. It's only at the words that we know that we can even see things or understand them. And that seems to be so true in the way you're rediscovering these words.
Yeah, well, we could think of it as a sort of rewilding, to use a term that's very busy in this country ecologically in terms of land management and disputes over land management. We could, you know, it's that we make do with so many generics, so, you know, field, hill, stream. There's a beautiful map of North America. I might send it through, see if you can find it to post with the program. But it maps the changing terms in color. It maps the changing terms for creek across North America. And you see this incredible kind of rainbow of differences. And it changes sort of regionally. It changes where weather changes. It's a beautiful way of seeing specificity, but also diversity. And that's why what I want is to give us the wildflower meadow of language for talking about nature, for talking about landscape, rather than the golf course fairway. That's the generic, that's the monoculture, that's, you know, ryegrass or whatever, or turtles all the way down, ryegrass all the way down. But we, my goodness, we're language making, naming creatures. and children are so good at it, right? They don't use generics, or they're perfectly happy to make up specifics. So precision is a form of lyricism and a form of poetry. It's also a form of pragmatism, and these words I gathered, and the language I celebrate in the use of other writers and speakers is precise and lyrical and practical.
You're listening to Life Examined on KCRW, and my guest this hour is Robert McFarlane, writer, naturalist, and author of Underland, A Deep Time Journey. You can stay connected to Life Examined by finding us on Facebook. Go behind the scenes of the show, connect with other listeners, and tell us what you'd like to hear on the show. You can find a link to the group at kcrw.com/lifeexamined or by searching in Facebook for KCRW Life Examined. I'm Jonathan Bastian. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. We just heard Robert McFarlane talk about the use of language in nature and the rediscovery of forgotten words. He also mentioned a map of North America showing how the names for creek change across the country. You can find that, by the way, at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. Let's now jump back into my conversation with Robert McFarlane and discuss an unexpected project that emerged out of the pandemic. Well, most recently, our listeners might also be surprised that you've jettisoned the world of writing behind you, although not quite, and have now actually been more involved in a very wonderful musical project and in the creation of an album called Lost in the Cedar Wood, which I want to talk about. You worked very closely with a musician, Johnny Flynn, but maybe you can welcome us to this album and tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I have very little musical ability myself. So, my greatest achievement musically as a child was sitting on my brother's clarinet and snapping it in two. That's pretty much the sum total of it. So it's slightly odd, much as you know, a mountaineer who lives in Cambridgeshire. But I've become a non-musician who works a very great deal with musicians, and among them perhaps most closely with Johnny Flynn, who's an actor, incredible actor. Your listeners may have seen him most recently in Emma, in the big film of Emma that came out about 18 months ago, and he's all over your screens as well as the music stations. He's just dazzlingly gifted. So we've worked together, been friends for a long time, and when lockdown came, we both, you know, we were stuck in the same place like so many people, and we just decided to throw out this lifeline to each other and begin a quiet collaboration. It began as a song, and then it grew and it became an album. And the album had at its heart, at its root, the oldest story in world literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh, which I've already mentioned. And we both kind of read this, and it became the nourishment that drove the writing of these 11 songs that we then released as this album, Lost in the Cedarwood. And it's just kind of taken on its own wild life since then. The album came out. It's then become a stage show which we toured. I should say I stayed in my jeans and grey jumpers. I didn't kind of, no spangly trousers, much as I kind of longed for my rock star youth. But and then it's being turned into a full dramatization, full theatre piece and audio. And it's just sort of something about what we've all gone through, the role of story and music in grappling with it, and the return to this most ancient of stories, the Epic of Gilgamesh. So,
yes. And so maybe explain how that epic story winds its way through the album. Were you looking for fragments of it or a retelling of the story? How did that work?
Well, we both read it. I'd read it already. Johnny, I just mentioned it to Johnny because I knew he's fascinated with orality and literacy and the old, and you know, old stories. And he read it in that first week of the first lockdown here in mid-March 2020, and he was just absolutely gripped by it. It's I think where there's a poet who described it as a fireball blazing through time. This story, it comes to us from 4,000 years away, but it strikes with the force of a revelation. At the heart of it is, terrible governance, toxic masculinity, ecological devastation, plagues unleashed upon the world, the grappling with mortality. As some of my students here in Cambridge would say, it's highly relatable and it's uncanny. It's another of those unburials, right? It meets us with contemporaneity and shocks us. So, you know, every time we finished a song, we were just avid to write the next one. It was absolutely clear what would happen. We were just catalyzed by this myth.
Well, let's take a listen here to the first track on the album. This is called 10 Degrees of Strange.
There's a black dog following hard on my tree. Set firm on hollowing my heart till it fades. Got 9 days sleepless, seeking to keep this dog off my tree.
So, Robert, tell us about that first track, 10 Degrees of Strange, we just heard a bit of. What's happening there? A lot of evocative language. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, you just hear Johnny's unbelievable skills as a guitarist. You hear that amazing kind of sort of slide guitar going on there. And he plays with an incredible resonator guitar from the 1940s, which is just astonishing, sort of creature of an instrument. And it's about depression. It's about grief and loss, and you know the dog that follows us all, and we can't shake it off our tail. I've gone 9 days sleepless seeking to keep this dog off my tail, but none of us can ever outrun it. And it corresponds very loosely, as you can hear, that you know you don't need to know Gilgamesh to listen to the album, but there's a Gilgamesh's dear friend Enkidu dies of this plague, and Gilgamesh sets out into the wilderness wandering, and he's trying to search for immortality for himself. He's trying to get away from the grief that he feels from the loss of Enkidu, but he can't do either. And it's about insomnia. I mean, all of these things that we live ourselves daily, he has to pass through a tunnel of spiders that lasts for seven days and nights, and he mustn't fall asleep in it. He has to pass through a mountain pass guarded by scorpions and lion creatures. And, you know, what more vivid evocation of our own battles with our demons could be wanted than this ancient god king trying to outpace his sadness?
And it strikes me that, you know, over these last 2 years, I think so many of us have perhaps been forced to reckon with a little bit of the 10 degrees of strange or a little bit of the darkness as our lives have ground to a halt, or as the world has felt more unknowable or uncertain than perhaps it has in many of our lifetimes.
Absolutely. And I mean, no one has gone untouched. So, you know, people have suffered grievously and calamitously, and it's on degrees, of course, of a spectrum of experiences, but no one has gone untouched. And one of the weird and terrible paradoxes of it was not being able to run, right? You couldn't leave, you were stuck, you were in, shelter in place. And so the demons had time to gather and feast. And so this song really was written out of, you know, in part out of that. And it's the song which has a music video with it. It's up there on YouTube, and it was done by an incredible American artist, claymation animator called Lynn Tomlinson. And we wanted to work with Clay partly because what she does is like nothing visually I've ever seen before, but also because the Epic of Gilgamesh is recorded on clay tablets. That those were the books of the ancient Babylonian and Akkadian civilizations. They were so pressed in cuneiform into wet tablets of wet clay and then baked, and that's how they've survived.
Wow, interesting. Well, that was the first track of the album, and I was very touched by the last track. It's kind of this very profound bookend to the story, and it's has a much kind of quieter and somber feel. This is called Ferryman. So let's take a listen to that right now.
Ferryman, ferryman, carry my memory on out to the island on the horizon, following the path of the sun. Following the path of the sun.
Well, Robert, that again, that's the final track. Some really beautiful and just the opening there, the idea of being, you know, transported, some aspect of us to, you know, to the horizon. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'm really glad you like it, Jonathan. It's probably the song that has my heart most. There are personal reasons for that. Someone very dear to me suffered a terrible accident early in lockdown, and I wrote that, you know, when things look very bleak for that person. I wrote really the lyrics in one sitting. It was one of those, some songs you kind of tinker over, like a, you know, beloved car or motorbike, a kind of year-long project, and others just come in a rush. And that one, as soon as I had, you know, Ferryman, carry my memory on, out to the island on the horizon, following the path of the sun, I just knew there was a song there. And then Johnny, you know, we would correspond by WhatsApp because we couldn't meet because we were in lockdown, and so a lot of it was done by voice. And then I'd get a kind of voice memo back from Johnny, and I just remember listening to that chorus the first time, what he'd done with it, and just, well, I cried. I'm not crying at the kind of beauty of my own work. It's not that. It was something bigger, and what Johnny had done with it. And it's really resonated with people. It's been played at funerals here quite a lot now. A lot of people who've suffered loss and grief of their own have, you know, written their stories to talk to us about that track. So it has a correspondence in the at the end of Gilgamesh, where Gilgamesh is trying to visit the island of immortality. That's where Utnapishti, who's the one survivor of the flood, lives, who knows what immortality is. And Gilgamesh thinks if only he can get out to the island on the horizon, he'll live forever, but he can't, of course.
It sounds like this is a book that, and a song that we're forced to sit with this kind of great question, this great unknowable of an afterworld or lack of, or what we aspire to know of it, but very kind of profound ancient questions.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say that. Have you read Gilgamesh, Jonathan?
This is one of the embarrassing moments where I say no. It's a book that's kind of haunted me around and sat on bookshelves, but I swear after this interview I'm going to go pick it up.
There's no embarrassment, because it's little read, oddly. It doesn't have the cultural currency of the, let's say, the Iliad or the Odyssey, and that's partly because it disappeared for thousands of years. It was only rediscovered in the 1850s, and then translated in the 1870s for the first time in thousands of years. So it's like a young ancient story, but in the 150 years since then, in fact it's 150 years exactly this year since its first translation, it's just traveled so wide and so hard and fast, and met so many people and been retold in so many cultures and places. But what struck me about what you said is that you're exactly right. Intuitively, the epic does not tie itself up neatly in a red ribbon. There are no take home, carry out, gift bag morals in the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's an extremely unsatisfying, inconclusive ending, which seems to me exactly as it should be, because these are frayed ends. These are margins that we live on and drift towards.
Well, finally, I, for you as somebody who has probably spent so many hours locked away in a study, writing your books and thinking and researching, and to work in the realm of music, you talked about just the emotion that comes over you when the sound comes back, when when, you know, when the melody comes to you.
Yeah.
KCRW, the station here, is one that is full of music. And I guess for you, what's been the power of working in that medium in a way that might have been unexpected or wonderful for you?
Oh, well, first of all, it's such a joy to talk to you and to reach your listeners and to be part of this station, which is, you know, so musical and part of the world that I would love to know better. So thank you all for this time. And then, yeah, I sometimes joke about it. It's like the Johnny Flynn song machine. It's like I text off these lyrics, and then about a day later, back comes this demo, sort of tickers out of the machine, and those moments are so special to me. Hearing a song take form in air. I work with these seven musicians for what's called the Spell Songs Ensemble, who set poems that I wrote for these books, The Lost Words and the Lost Spells. Sekou Keita on the kora, and Julie Fowlis on the Gaelic whistles and voice, and I'm just and watching. I think it is the purest form of magic to me. Writing is labor and trowel work and concentration and perspiration in locked rooms, and you know, no one would ever want to watch a writer write, right? it's paint drying, it's grass growing. But musicians are magicians weaving golden thread that they pluck from the air, and when I watch it actually happening in the moment, there's no kind of greater secular miracle to me.
Well, my guest this hour has been the writer Robert McFarlane. He's the author of Underland, A Deep Time Journey, and the collaborator on a new album called Lost in a Cedar Wood with musician Johnny Flynn. Robert, we've journeyed up the mountains, gone below ground, rediscovered some old words, and ended with some music. It's been a wonderful hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I've loved our conversation.
Well, that's it for this week. The producer of our show is Andrea Brody. And if you want to hear more of the music, discover Robert's writing, and catch up on old shows, make sure to join our Facebook group and continue the conversation. You can also connect with me on Instagram at JonathanWBastian. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you next week.